You're listening to SBS Radio, and my name is Margarita Vasilova. On today's Macedonian program and segment in which we interview Australian Macedonians, I'll be looking at the extraordinary life of Manoli Germanchev, or Oli Germansis, as he's better known, retired chemical engineer and longtime STEM teacher in physics and mathematics, who, after spending the first 8 years of his life in a humble Macedonian village as a shepherd boy, and after migrating to Melbourne in 1960, became a chemical engineer who went on to design, develop and test the cluster bomb for the Australian Defence Forces, later used in the Vietnam War. During his teaching career, he's been an inspiration to students, resulting in a multitude of engineering careers taking off, and all this stemming from what he says was spurred on by an ever-present desire to know how things work. Oli Germansis has written a book titled My Childhood Memories, From a Shepherd to a Chemical Engineer. And it's published by Politicon Publications and can't be purchased because it's free. One of hundreds of free ebooks on the Politicon Publications website. Manoli Germanchev, thank you for speaking with SBS Macedonian.
Thank you very much, Margarita, for asking me to talk about my book. My book was written about my childhood memories between the time of 1952 and 1960, a period of about 8 years. So it doesn't really cover all my life story, so I can't call it a memoirs.
No.
But that period was really, really beautiful and influential in me getting my degree in chemical engineering.
Yes.
So
yes.
I want to talk a little bit about it. First, I want to describe the village.
Yes, please
the
do.
The village is actually nestled in northwest Greece, what is Greece now, but at that time, you know, in the early years, it was part of Macedonia. And my grandparents are truly ethnic Macedonians. The only language they knew was Macedonian, and only the verbal language. So basically, we come from a long line of ethnic Macedonians. I was raised by my grandparents because my father and mother were, well, my father was in Australia trying to earn money to bring us to Australia. My mother, on the other hand, she had this bad infection in her ankle, and she was always away seeking a cure. She didn't want her leg amputated. So basically, I was raised by my grandfather, me, my sister, and my brother. And the sort of jobs we did there was jobs that a small kid can do, mm-hmm. such as watching the strawberries or looking after the sheep.
Did you like looking after the sheep?
I enjoyed it. The sheep are so peaceful, so beautiful. The scenery in that region is amazing.
Yes.
There are mountains that are probably 2,000 metres tall, a lot of deciduous trees, the rivers with clear water.
Yes.
And, of course, the good part about that region is it's got really distinct seasons. A winter in Macedonia at that time lasts for about 3 months and it's just covered with snow. You really see a winter there.
Yes.
The temperatures are low, you know, below 10 degrees. Even though we didn't have a thermometer. We didn't know how cold it was, but certainly it was very cold. And again, summers were nice and steady. Autumn, we used to farm, gather our fruit, strawberries, watermelons, everything we grew for ourselves. We really lived on a subsistence farming. We grew all our food and we depended on our sheep, but milk and wool. You can say basic organic life there.
Yes. Something we're trying to recreate now.
Well, there are quite a few hippies now that, you know, want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they still got the backup of the supermarket. In our time, there's no supermarket. And there's no central link. If the crops didn't come in, you didn't eat. Well, look, basically what it is, we had plenty of time to sit there, look at the scenery, and think about things. There's no distractions. There's no television. There's no radio even. We spent most of the time with our relatives, friends, and neighbours. There's a lot of time to actually talk about things. But as a kid, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed, as I said, nature, observing things, see how things work. But at the same time, I could notice that people were nervous. They had a lot of anxiety about, because the war had just finished then. The war had finished in 1949. I was born in 1947, so I was 2 years old, and I was born during the last phases of the war. But their parents, who actually suffered the war, who saw death, who saw injuries, that doesn't go away in a hurry. That's the sort of thing I can remember. and I don't want to read too much into it because I'm not a psychologist, but I'm just saying that's what I observed.
Yes, that whole sense of the aftermath of war is transmitted almost automatically to the next generation.
I sort of wrote like a technical report.
That must have been easy.
So people confuse it. When I said I wasn't good at writing, I mean, I wasn't good at writing novels.
Yes.
If you asked me to write a novel or describe a character or form a situation, I'd be lost. But there are two things. If you ask me to write something that I'm passionate about, which is my life, you know, the time I spend in Macedonia, beautiful stuff. Or if you ask me to write something about technical things, you know, machines, especially cars, I could go on forever.
Well, it is a very easy form that you write in.
In addition to that, I've tried to sort of keep the words down to the level of what a year 10 person would know. I didn't want it to be too complicated.
Yes, I did have the sense that you were being the teacher, and you know, in some instances there.
Well,
after teaching for 28 years, I guess it's a pattern that that can't leave you very easily.
Well, it's true. I also develop a pattern where I introduce a topic, I get the kids interested, but I don't quite give them the answer, and I let them finish off the topic or the answer. One example is actually my son-in-law pointed this out because he too is an engineer, and I was talking about how trucks either drive through one wheel or two wheels, and I couldn't work out how. And I thought it's possibly they only drive through one wheel, one rear wheel, because if they drive through both wheels, the other wheel would skid against the dirt road.
Oh.
And of course, that, you know, that facility in the trucks is done by the differentials. Okay, there's a little hump in the back axle, and in there are gears, and they call them differential. That does the job of transferring the drive from left to the right, but I didn't want to go and explain that because as a 10-year-old, I wasn't to know that. I found that out later, and this is what I tried to teach people reading my book, to observe things and try to work them out for themselves later.
One of your many techniques.
Well, that's my method of getting kids interested in learning. What I found out with teaching is that kids are interested in the answer. They're not always interested in working out. And that doesn't teach them anything. They just forget it, you know?
Right.
But as they learn it for themselves, they'll never forget it.
Now, you felt you had to go back, you know, and get in touch with your emotions, your feelings, and the sounds of things, the smells of things of the past in order to write this book. Why was that?
Yeah, well, I wanted to write it, and I tried to write it for over a period of 5 years. But then I'd sit down at the table and thinking that I've got two spare hours and in there I might put in two pages.
Right.
But nothing came along. I couldn't do it. To do it, you had to actually transport yourself. I had to transport myself in that situation and actually see the river or see the mountains. And then I can talk about it. And that sort of inspiration or that sort of transportation to that field takes ages. You know, you've got to be in the right mood at the right time, and that's why it took me so long to write it.
Yes, yes.
A competent author would probably have written this book in about a week. You know, it's such a small book.
Well, I guess question that many writers who intend to write an autobiography would ask themselves, why would anyone want to read my life? What made you write it?
Yes, it is true. You know, it is true. But I'm in a unique situation because out of our close-knit family, I'm the only person that was born overseas. And now it's particularly about my son, mainly, who married into an Anglo-Saxon family. And there, we've got grandchildren. As they've grown up, they started to call me Dedal, which is Macedonian grandfather.
Yes.
While the father of the mother's side is called Granddad, and the mother is called Nana. And I thought to myself, in one situation, they would want to know why we got different names. And in addition to that, my son, who is proud of his heritage, he has reverted back to his Macedonian name. He calls himself Anthony Germanchuk.
I see.
And I still kept my Greek name, you know, the name that was given to us by the Greek government there, as Manoli Chimensis. And that is a further confusion. So I thought the best way to explain that is actually through a book. Because as I found out, even with a discussion with my son, who we get on very well and he wants to know these things, because there isn't enough time to explain these things. We are stressed out for time. And also he said, people haven't got the retention. They're not patient enough to listen to you for more than about 20 minutes. So that's why the only way I can do that is write a book and let them read the book whenever they got time.
That's right. Well, it's there black on white for them to refer to whenever they want to.
In addition to that, Margarita, I sort of feel relieved that I actually put it down on paper, because this was bothering me all the time. You know, thinking about how nice it was and whatever. I wish I could tell it to somebody. Mm-hmm. And it just came out. It came out nicely.
You must have held a lot of love for that part of your life, Ollie, obviously, because you were so involved in how everything worked and how everything fell into place in those first formative years, first 8 years of your life. There must have been a lot of love as well towards what you experienced in the two villages in Macedonia.
Well, I suppose it was. My grandfather really took on to me, you know. He sort of treated me like a partner, like a grandchild. Yes. He took me around with business deals that he was doing. It. He introduced me to adults. He didn't treat me like a kid. He didn't say, oh, you can sit in the corner or play with a donkey or something like that. Mm-hmm. While I do, you know, while I talk to my adult friends, you know. He always involved me with adults. So, in a way, I matured early, and I got a fairly good knowledge of how things operated.
He must have spotted your potential.
Well, that, and also he probably didn't have much choice, because most of his sons had gone away. I wanted to go to Australia, start a better life. So I was probably the next male in line to take over and look after the property. He was intended to stay there all the time, you know, he must have gone all the time. But as it turned out, he eventually came to Australia, and he lived there for about 4 years until he passed away.
What's also fascinating is how you view your transformation, you know, how you find the passage from shepherd to chemical engineer so incredible.
Well, I'm not trying to put any particular, you know, occupation down, but if I stay there, the only choice I had would have been a shepherd or a farmer or a subsistence farming. There were no choices of any other career. The Greek government wouldn't allow us to take on jobs in their government or whatever, you know, proper jobs.
Why was
that? We're just destined to work on farms and for our own, and scratch the living from our own land.
Why
tiny amount of land too, you know, 5 acres at the most. That's all we had.
So it's all pretty limiting, wasn't it?
You call it limited or something, but the soil there is fertile, and it's enough to produce food and maintain a family of about 6 or 7 or 8 people if you work hard and if the environment is cooperated. Sometimes you don't get a crop. Sometimes you get a bad winter, but, you know, you don't get the rainfall that you expect, and things don't always go right. But we managed to survive in those 8 years. Things were okay for us.
Well, the book, My Childhood Memories, From a Shepherd to a Chemical Engineer, you've set it out very methodically and you guide the reader every step of the way through first setting the historical context and then, of course, to very informative descriptions of life in the two villages, Neret and Mala. You've included also simple sketches throughout the chapters to illustrate some of the farm equipment and toys you've made and objects and machinery used for production on the land. And there's also a few descriptions of the neighbouring villages and what's characteristic about them, which is very amusing.
Yeah. Well, I did that. I can say I wanted to look authentic, so I didn't get photographs or so on. So most of the sketches are done by me, including the front cover. But I didn't intend to be an engineer. I just wanted to learn how things work. And basically, when you get the opportunity to go to school and learn things, the only subjects that can deeply teach you about how things work are mathematics mainly, then physics, and then chemistry. And they are the subjects I did. And as it turned out, you know, I was quite successful at them because I sort of understood it right from the, I can say, from the basic fundamental background, you know, where you observe these things in nature. You know, for example, I've got an example there that I wanted to work out how thunder works and how lightning and thunder actually are connected.
Yes.
We sort of noticed that, lightning comes first, and a few seconds later, thunder comes along. And then in other times, the thunder doesn't come along, or you don't hear it, or it comes along at a long time, different time. And so there must be a connection, you know. And I, of course, didn't work it out there, but as I kind of studied physics, the connection is the speed of light versus the speed of sound. And that tells you how far in time they are apart, because sound is much slower than light. And if you know the speed of sound, you can work out how far the lightning is from where you are. Those things just fascinated me, to be able to work that out.
Now, you also describe in the book that it was quite by accident that you came to study chemical engineering, or rather go to a technical school in the first place, because of a mistake that your father made.
Yeah, well, look, at that time, this is 1960, we came in February 1960, and of course school starts in Australia, January, you know, just there. My father said, school start in July, which they do in Europe. Yes. He said, wait till July, then go to another school. So he said, also your English is, well, you've got no English, zero English. I didn't know a word of English. He said, we'll send you to a primary school. So I went to the primary school, North Richmond Primary School, for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, I still wasn't good enough to, my dad thought I wasn't good enough to go to secondary school. So he asked me to do primary school again. Okay, so I went there, and the primary school didn't help me a lot in picking up English. The schoolyard taught me how to speak English. Would you believe that? The teachers were not prepared, or they didn't know, the primary school teachers, they didn't know. It was a time where they thought England ruled the world and everybody in the world spoke English. And this kid here who came from Greece doesn't speak English, it means he must be not very bright. That's what I gathered, you know, that was the situation. And you'd be amazed who taught me to speak English. You probably know this man. He was a pop star in the 1970s, relatively important pop star. And his name was Russell Morris. He was my first English or Australian friend who was bothered to talk to me, explain things to me. But he was fascinating because he's a very bright and very social person, you know.
Right.
So we mixed it well, and we spoke in the yard with him. And if there's any English that I picked up, would it be from him rather than the primary school teachers?
From Russell Morris.
Yeah.
Who would be able to guess that? That's incredible. Bravo to Russell Morris. You're really grateful for the fact that you actually had qualified engineers.
Well, yeah. If you can teach
physics,
for example, or mathematics, you want to be taught by a physicist. If you want to teach chemistry, you want to be taught by a chemist. And that's where these people were. In high schools, people study a degree in education with a bit of knowledge about chemistry or a bit of knowledge of mathematics. But these people actually knew it better, and they actually used it in experience. Most of these engineers were actually had practical experience. And also they loved the topic because they talked about things that they did at home. There's one mechanical engineer was talking about the boat that was building and all the problems he was having, you know? Mm-hmm. Problems to do with salt water, for example. He's trying to put an engine there from a car to work in a boat. Obviously, in their boat, motors have got engines that can stand up to salt water. But at that time, he didn't have engines like that. So problems with water leaking or water corroding the metal and so on. And I love this sort of stuff, real life experiences and problems, and how do we solve it instead of theoretical work.
Do you think, Ollie, that aspect is lacking in our schools?
That aspect is lacking, and it's gradually been attended to, but not to a great extent, really. What our schools are trying to do, because I'm going back now, I've left the schools about 15 years ago, more retired, but at that time, all the high school teachers, their biggest aim was to educate kids to go to uni and become teachers themselves. So they're sort of repeating the cycle. I'm a teacher, I'll educate you to become a teacher. I'm not educating people either to make things, how things work, or to improve things, or how to think. And I felt good technical schools, which were there at that time in the 1960s, were doing that, as well as preparing apprentices for trades and so on.
Yes.
But if you want to do technology, like in the level of engineering, you get plenty of people there to help you, to guide you along. And, of course, on the other hand, technical school will not stop you if you want to do law. They'll take you up to a level of year 11. So from now on, going to a high school or going to a private school and teach the humanities stuff, so you become a lawyer. So there's no hindrance. If you went to a technical school, it doesn't mean you had to end up as a motor mechanic or plumber. You could be anything.
Well, what did you think about the time during the Kennett years when a lot of the technical institutes were closed?
Well, look, I was very disappointed, really, of course.
SBS.
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 SBS Radio.
I have not read a book up to the age of 12. Our school back in Macedonia, the Greek primary school, had only one set of class books, and that was to teach us how to pronounce each letter of the alphabet correctly. There was a caption there, a drawing or something, and then a little caption saying, I'll say it in Greek now, Iaia Zini Gala Stin Megata. That was the only book, set of books in the school. The next book that I read was when I was in Athens, in the hotel. There was a magazine with a picture of my mother, because my mother wore a traditional Macedonian dress when she was coming to Australia.
Right.
And some photographer thought this was a fantastic shot. She took a picture and put it on the front page. Then I looked at it. I showed Mum. Mum wasn't interested because Mum was stressed out. There's an article about diving, deep water diving, with all these brass suits, pressure, and I read it, and I enjoyed it. And I said, that's the sort of thing I want to read, technical stuff. It's satisfying. I was curious. I don't know why I was curious, but I was only curious about wanting to know how things work in the physical world. And, of course, we are living in a physical world, you know. We need to know how things work, and when they break, we need how to fix them up. Or in addition to that, we need to know how to keep them going, you know, stop them from breaking.
Well, that deep desire of yours to know how things work earned you a degree in chemical engineering, after which you worked as an experimental officer in the Defence Standard Laboratories, the DSL, where you designed, developed, or you were part of a team at least, which designed, developed and tested military weapons for use in the Vietnam War, in particular the cluster bomb, which was top secret for many decades. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Not only that, there are other, you know, projects that were secret. There was also, we made a tracer bullet that could outstand the humidity in the Vietnam jungles. We also made a self-destructing exocet missile, you know, a missile that you fire from an aircraft into another aircraft or into a boat. But in case the missile misses the target,
yes,
and it flies away, we do want it to actually go into a populated area and do a lot of destruction, because they were huge, hugely powerful weapons. We put in a built-in destruction mechanism where the thing would break in pieces and fall down instead of going too far away from where the target was supposed to be. So there were many topics, not only one. We also did I don't want to talk about the cluster bomb because really it annoys me. I did want to develop weapons that are, you know, deadly. And goodness, sake, the cluster bomb has been banned now. No country actually uses a cluster bomb. But in addition to that, we did other social projects. We also built a rocket that was going to see the clouds, you know, send silver chloride into the clouds, or silver halide, some sort of crystal chemical, which will force the clouds to condense into water and bring us rain. That topic wasn't quite finished because by that time I sort of left DSL. I only worked there for about 3.5 years, I'd say.
So the STEM subjects, of course, are science, technology, engineering and mathematics. What is your feeling about these subjects? Why are they so important? Because there is a push to try and interest new generations in these subjects.
Well, again, it's a strange question, you know. For me, the way I grew up, observed things in nature, wanted to find out how things work. I think I also described how this eagle tried to lift up one of our lambs, and he was unsuccessful in doing it, and the way he flapped his wings.
Mm-hmm.
And that was reminiscent of how helicopters work, how aeroplanes work, and that led me, I thought it's fantastic. It's fantastic how we learn from nature how to make vehicles or machines that can mimic nature. And for me, he didn't have to encourage me to do math or science topics. It was just born into me. But the way that the education department is going, trying to incite kids to do math or science, if they go along the lines to say, oh, do that, there's a lot of need for engineers or scientists, or you'll have a better pay, or you'll it's an easier job, it doesn't work. It's got to come from the heart, or it's got to come from being inquisitive. And this part about being inquisitive, it is, I don't know where it comes from. Must come from DNA from somewhere, but I can't answer the question, really.
I think that's a very important component in your case.
Yeah, well, okay, look, if I could tell you that both of my children, which is Stephanie, my daughter, and Anthony, they're both engineers, and Stephanie is an aerospace engineer, which is the top, you know, level of engineering, if you like, and Anthony's a robotics engineer. Now, I didn't tell him to do it, nor did I do it because there's a lot of money in it. They sort of did it because they saw my enthusiasm about engineering. So my enthusiasm somehow rubbed off onto them.
Yes.
So that's what you need. You have to create enthusiasm. And, of course, with some people, there are a lot of cousins and a lot of nephews, and none of them did engineering because even though they expressed the same enthusiasm, it didn't work. It still works for few and particular people. And having said that, we should encourage people to do STEM subjects, but we don't want everybody to do STEM subjects at a tertiary level. I want them to do it at a level where they can understand how to use forces, for example, or they can understand when people are talking about, you know, this food has got acid or pH of this food is 3 or something, you know, and acids are good for you. Well, if you know a bit of chemistry, you'll find out whether it's true or not. Because there's a lot of talk about both foods and exercises and taking supplements, and they talk about antioxidants, they talk about radicals, they talk about ions, you know, reduce your, putting this plug in the PowerPoint,
yes.
It'll eliminate the ions that are in the air. If you knew some of those things, you'll work out that those things don't actually work. They don't eliminate ions and antioxidants all over the place, and in some cases, you don't need them. For example, just to tell you, oxidation takes part when you combine oxygen with carbon and produce carbon dioxide. So in other words, carbon is oxidized. Now, do you want your carbon in your body to be oxidized? You know, some of the foods sort of promote that. I think people who sell foods or who promote things, they use technical words that a lot of people don't really know just to make it sound authentic, you know, to make it important that people would buy the product.
What's your suggestion?
My suggestion is people should learn the same subjects up to a level to understand things like that, but follow a different career, a career that they love. You might be an artist, you might be a chef, you might do something else, but learn a bit of physics, a bit of chemistry to the level to understand these people who try to sell you products that are based on that emotional advertising about scientific things being good for you all the time.
Right. So what you're actually suggesting is that the school systems should incorporate the STEM subjects, not so much on an elective level, but...
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually, because till now, I was teaching physics all the time, year 11, year 12, but the students start physics at year 11. They're not introduced to it at year 8, 9, 10, and so on. And the teachers that are teaching that, most of the teachers, they hold physics at a top level. They hold it as something that you aspire to. And in some cases, they say, oh, you're not good enough to do these things. So they tip it away from the general population. And even maths teachers do that too. You know? People that teach specialist maths say, well, why teach specialist maths? You know, you can't do this sort of thing to other kids. They shouldn't use that approach. They should introduce it slowly and let the kid choose whether he wants to go further or not.
So, in other words, introduce these STEM subjects at a much earlier age, maybe
earlier
on a practical
age,
level.
Yes.
And I think
really the whole education system needs an overhaul, really. The high school teachers that normally got the job now, secondary school teachers, football high school teachers, they themselves have never been out of education institution. They finish their uni course and go straight to the teaching. They don't do experience. They don't know whether it's used
industry,
anywhere.
Yes.
And they can't actually transmit this love for the subject if they haven't actually used it somewhere. It's a difficult topic, but here we are. We're moving away from the topic again. That's from my book.
Not necessarily, because obviously that enthusiasm that you held right from an early age,
You've
obviously managed to transmit that in order to encourage your students to tackle STEM subjects, and many of which have taken up engineering, science, biology, medicine, as you point out in your book.
Look, really, another thing I want to talk about really is my love for cars. You know, the design and construction and application of cars, motor cars, and aeroplanes, any sort of machine. Not so much the fact that I've got a very expensive car or I've got a very powerful car. I want to talk about a well-designed car where it uses the laws of physics to be as efficient as possible and to be as safe as possible and to actually apply the knowledge into constructing the car. I love doing that. And in the book, when I threw it towards there and I started talking about where I introduced extracurricular activities to do with cars. Some of the cars were electric powered, some were solar powered, and some were hybrids, you know, where you've got two or three different sources of energy to power the car. Now, the cars were small, like a single person, you couldn't register them, but it taught the students that this is the future, this is where you should be heading.
Yes.
And I was proud of that that situation. Because I remember one of the competitions we had at Maryborough, which was a 24-hour race. Can you believe it? 24-hour race.
Wow.
With hybrid cars and to find out which car could do the maximum laps. It's almost equivalent to Le Mans in France, where sports cars race for 24 hours
yes.
to see who can cover the maximum distance.
Yes, yes.
Well, this was our situation. It's a smaller scale, of course, the yes. speed was smaller, but the intent was there. And it's just amazing. One of the key hands for this, to do this project, we had to have about a group of 15 kids involved in it. They had to be involved in the construction of the car. They had to talk to a panel of judges about why they build it and what are the benefits, future benefits. Nothing even about telling the kids. I said, but the future benefits is, I probably won't see the development of these cars. I won't see a solar-powered car. You know, they'll come in between 30 or 40 years from now. I'll be dead by then. So I said, you guys, you're going to live in this world for another 70 or 80 years. And I said, you want that earth to be clean in that time. And would you believe one of the local newspapers interviewed the kid and he told him, why are you involved in this project? He said, because I want to live in a clean world. Now, that kid, I know that kid, went and did aerospace engineering himself. He's one of my, say, prize students.
Yes.
There you are. See, it inspires. But having said that, I don't want everybody to be an engineer. There's no room for that, you know. You need a whole cross-section of professions in this world. But they should have a basic understanding of both physics and chemistry, and certainly mathematics.
Yes.
I can tell you that my grandfather, who was illiterate in Greek, because Greek was a grammar language then, because, you know, by that time, Greece had taken over Macedonia. It doesn't mean my grandfather was not intelligent. He was a genius. Because when you see those people, the way they work the field, the way they know when to sow it, they know the animals, they know how to treat the animals to get the maximum out of the land, they knew their profession.
Yes.
Their profession was farming. So when you're good at your profession, I can say people are smart. And that's what I like about my grandparents. Did you get to the stage in the book where we're distilling rakia, which is
yes.
which is a sort of a spirit similar to whiskey?
Yes.
Okay, well, that the distillation in itself is a chemical engineering process where you separate two liquids, and the majority of the liquids in that situation is water and alcohol. So if you heat the liquid slowly, you don't reach the temperature of the boiling of water, which is 100. If you keep it below 100, then the alcohol would evaporate first. Then you understand what people say, what is the boiling temperature of this liquid, what's the boiling temperature of that, and why is it important? It is important because you can separate those two mixtures by the virtue that they've got different boiling temperatures.
Right.
That is a beautiful concept to understand. And that was explained to me by my grandfather, even though he didn't study chemistry or engineering himself.
It's extraordinary.
As I said, we made our own wine. You put the wine, you squash the grapes, you press them, you put the liquid, you know, the juice into the barrel and you wait for fermentation. And the fermentation doesn't start. We used to put a hot rock inside the barrel to start the fermentation. Now, in chemistry, if you want to start a reaction, you have to give it an activation energy. They call it activation energy. You have to activate the process.
Mm-hmm.
And there we are. We're doing it from natural aptitude, you know. We're not told by anybody. We sort of picked it up. And where does this come from? I don't know. By accident, you know. Somebody dropped a hot rock in the barrel and they found out that it does work. But then if the days when the wine was fermented were warm in the night and the chemical reaction started to go quicker, process much quicker, well, that alcohol that's in the wine turns into vinegar. So you want to keep the reaction slow. To do that, they used to put a wet blanket on top of the barrel, another form of controlling the reaction.
Yes.
And this is, you know, chemistry, organic chemistry we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I was learning organic chemistry at the age of 10. And this is what should be taught at schools at the age of 10, you know, when kids are in year
yes.
7 or something, you know, primary school.
Yes. And your dealer wasn't the only one. Your Vuiko Stoyan, or Uncle Stoyan, made a spring-powered rifle from abandoned military parts.
Well, he's a genius. Yeah, he came into Australia at the age of probably, I don't know what, 25 or something.
Right.
He started up his own building industry in Perth. He built units, so he became a successful builder. Without qualification, without learning how to draw plans, but he did it all himself. I don't know, he had the natural aptitude to both learning and understanding what was going on. He was the one who actually gave me a very good description of how the flour mill works. You know, they had a flour mill.
Yes, yes.
Powered by water, of course. And he took me down into it, which was built underground, because, you know, to get the fall of the water, to get the water pressure, you had to, you know, build a water mill a bit lower than what the water was coming from.
Yes.
Anyway, Tom there showed me these great big stones with holes in them, showed me the impeller that turns it, and all these other little levers and little compartments where they dribble the grain, you know, either the corn or the wheat slowly, and they crush it. The thing comes out. It flies out from the perimeter of the rock. And in physics, we call that a centrifugal force. The centrifugal force throws the flour out. And by controlling how fast you're turning the clock rate, which means by controlling how much water is sent to the impeller, you can control how fine you grind the wheat, what sort of flour you get.
What kind of force was that? Because the line's not very clear. What kind of force was that again?
Centrifugal.
Oh, centrifugal force.
Centrifugal force, the force that goes away from the centre.
Right.
Yeah, it sends things away from the centre. You know, it's sort of the same thing that if you tie something at the end of a string and you swing it over your head, that is how people demonstrate centrifugal force. And that's what's happened with the wheat. You know, the turning of the rocks would give the flour a centrifugal force, which would force it out of the rocks and into this container, and that's where your flour is, you know. And then you go home and bake it and make bread.
There you are.
Incredible things were going on in the village, really.
Yes, yes.
In addition to that, we made our own bread, baked our own bread with our own footna, you know what a footna is, you know.
And you made your own toys?
I made my own toys because we couldn't buy toys. We didn't have money for starting, and there were no shops that sold toys. And I said then, make whatever I could make, just for the interest, not that I needed it, but I suppose my greatest joy was when I made this steerable fly, you know, with a sled, we call it. I found it on top of a roof because either my uncles or my parents were using it when they were younger. And I said, oh, you know, it goes in a straight line because how about if we make it turn? So I put an additional thing on it and I made it steerable and I also put a brake on it. And it also becomes like a snowmobile.
It's good that you highlight all of these things because we tend to forget that there was so much invention going on in the villages.
Our village wasn't a particularly big village, but it had a lot of things there. It had two flour mills, it had two distilleries, a foundry where people were making implements, you know, making their own flours or their own digging tools.
Yes.
Almost everything was made. The only thing we bought was kerosene for lamps at night, not to have light. And that's the only light we had. There was no electricity,
yes.
No running water in the houses, and no heating. The heating was done by wood, of course, but I mean no electric heating, no duct
heating. No,
for heaven's sake. I enjoyed it, though. I enjoyed it. Just unbelievable. I mean, you enjoy it when you see birds. We had every year a pair of swallows coming and building their nest out of mud. They were like builders. You know, so pick up a mud, position it correctly, and the nest would come out perfectly circular within, you know, the corner of two walls. So how did these birds do it? I didn't even have a ruler to measure it. But every year was identical size.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
And let's not forget the village wisdom and the well-known sayings imparted from the older folk to the young ones in teaching them.
Well, really, in winter, there's nothing to do in winter at night. And you just sit there and listen to stories from your grandfather. There's a lot of stories my grandfather told us. And there's one story that I mentioned there about Stratinoja, of course. That came from him, you know.
Nastavinoda, okay.
Well, some people pronounce it different. Depends what part of Macedonia you're from, but Nasrettin Hoca is a Turkish word. He's a mythical person from Turkey, or Muslim rather than Macedonian. But all the region uses it. The Greeks call him some other name, but we call him Nasrettin Hoca.
Well, what insights has writing this book given you?
What insights?
Have you learned anything more about yourself? What, I know you said that you felt relieved after writing it.
Yeah, because it was in me and I wanted to say it. But what have I learned? I learned if you've got a passion for something, you can do it even though if you're not really trained. And I'd say I wasn't trained in writing creatively. But, of course, I've learned that it's possible if you want to do it. Even now, as I'm talking about it, I'm looking at my wall here in the room, and about the same distance there, my teacher stood up in the wall with his hand, with a book in his right hand, and he almost, like said, "Now, believe that you guys can write books. Don't kid yourselves. Even though you come to a tech school and you're going to be a tradesman, you still have got the ability to write books." And he said, "You don't have to write those books the way authors write it." Like, he said, "You can write it in technical terms." And even now, I said, "You can." He said, "You can say his chin was angular, and the angle between his chin and his neck was 90 degrees. You can use words like that. You can say his nose was like an isosceles triangle."
Yes.
I said, "I love that. He inspired people to, you know, to go into writing." And then, you know, looked at him, and then at that time I said, "Oh, come on, up in the right book. No way." That was my thought.
Yes.
But now it happened.
Yes.
It happened because, you know, the conditions came along. The need that my granddaughter would one day want to know why it's called Dedon, why her father's got a different name, you know, like a Macedonian name.
Mm-hmm.
And what is this mystical name of Macedonia? A lot of people heard of Macedonia, they're confusing it with the Greek Macedonia, because Greeks want to put it, they call the north part Macedonia. We, you know, the Pyrenean Macedonians, the ones that used to be originally Yugoslavia,
yes.
They still got that former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. So there's a lot of confusion about that name and also the ethnicity of Macedonians. But I can tell you, we are, and my kids know, we are truly ethnic Macedonians, and our ethnicity goes back as far as we can count, you know, hundreds of years. And we can sort of trace it back.
Absolutely. Well, Oleg Irmantjev, you have truly inspired me. I have to tell you, I have up until 2 weeks ago treasured two books in my library, the titles of which are How Things Work. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So I think this interview was destined to be. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for speaking with SBS Macedonian. If you were my teacher for engineering or physics or mathematics, I'm sure I wouldn't be sitting here interviewing you. We'd be partners in how things work.
Well, you probably would have been an engineer, but you probably wouldn't have been earning as much money as you are now.
We see. Well, there's not much money in broadcasting either.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, Mr. Richard.